Once the chronology is incorrectly established by academia, then the Bible becomes all myth. Once you re-establish the chronology in the correct timeline, then the Bible becomes real through archaeology.
Hi, I'm Evelyn Wright. Welcome to the Cauldron Pool Show. Today, I am joined by an incredible guest. Actually, when he agreed to joining me, I had to read the email a few times to just make sure it was real and that I wasn't dreaming. I have been an admirer of his work for a number of years. He's an incredible man. His name is David Roll. He is an Egyptologist. He has best-selling books that he has been the author for. He's also done many documentaries and documentary series, and his knowledge on history, especially with the Egypt timeline and a few things from that part of the world, is just out of this world. So I really want to welcome you today, and I hope my Australian audience are as equally as excited as I am to hear everything that you have to say.
Oh, it's lovely to be here, Evelyn. Very nice.
I was going to say, I've given you a little bit of an intro, but you have an incredible biography. As I said before, there, if I need to know something or I want to confirm something, you're the first person that I go to. I read your book or I watch something you've done. So I'd love for my Australian audience who might not be as familiar with you just to sort of get to know who you are and the sort of work that you have done up to this point.
Okay, well, I'm British to start off with, but I don't live in Britain anymore. I've actually moved to Spain about 12 years ago in a beautiful climate over here with the blue skies. And as you can see, I live in a Spanish villa, which is very, very beautiful type of construction, lovely house. And we live on top of a mountain overlooking the Mediterranean Sea. So my focus has always been the Mediterranean, whether it be Egypt or Israel or Greece or Crete or Italy, Anatolia, modern Turkey, all those areas of interest to me, as well as Spain and southern France. So I have a broad knowledge of this area. And it all began for me, really, when I was about 7 years old, when I was writing Egyptian hieroglyphs. We found in the attic, when we moved over to Spain, we found this great big scroll of paper with all the names of the Egyptian pharaohs written in hieroglyphs, and then in Greek, and then in English, with all their different dynasties. So what that was all about when I was 7 years old, I've no idea, but I've always been in love with the ancient world and especially Egypt. And then over the years, because I went to Egypt for the first time at the age of nine, traveled in King Farouk's paddle steamer all the way from Cairo to Abu Simbel. I actually slept in King Farouk's bed, but at the time he was in Italy because he'd been thrown out of the country because of the revolution that happened in Egypt. So it was quite an experience to be given the great key of Abu Simbel temple with a great Ankh symbol, brass key, and to be sent down the gangplank of the boat onto the beach in front of the temple before the sunrise and told to go and open the great doors of the temple all on my own. And as I opened the doors, the sun rose behind the River Nile and lit my way all the way to the Holy of Holies. So that was one of the early experiences I had in Egypt. And I've loved the subject of Egyptology for all my life. But then I got into the usual thing about forming rock bands at the age of 16 and touring in Germany, doing the American bases there, etc. So I was in the music industry for about 25, 30 years. First of all, as a band member, I got a number of record deals from various companies in Britain. Then I became chief engineer at one of the most famous studios in Britain and eventually a record producer. And that all took all the way through my sort of mid-25s up to about the age of 35, 40. And then I got enough money from doing all that work, and I was getting pretty tired from doing all that studio work all the time, working in the early hours. I decided to retire from the music industry and to use the royalties that I'd earned from the sales of various albums to go to university. And guess what? I went to study. I went to study Egyptology and ancient history, which I'd been doing all my life in the background. So I got my degree at University College London and went on to do a PhD. And they invited me to give a lecture, public lecture, for the Egypt Exploration Society in London, which is a big, big society, Egyptology Society. And there was a literary agent in the audience, and he asked me at the end of the lecture, whether he could represent me as my agent. So I thought, well, all right. I'm quite interested in doing that, but of course I'm doing my PhD. And within a space of a couple of months, I had a book deal with Random House, and you have Random House in Australia as well. And I also had a TV series from Discovery Channel in America and Channel 4 in Britain. They co-produced it, which was called Pharaohs and Kings. Now, the book was called A Test of Time, which you probably read. And that was really the beginning of it all, really, because that was a bestseller, as you mentioned. And it sold a lot of books all around the world and quite a few in Australia. And since then, I've been writing several books. So it's been a long career, a mixed career, between early childhood in love with Egypt to doing the rock music and recording of albums for about 20, 25 years, and then going to university. And then with the sort of skills I obtained at university, I was able to do what I really wanted to do, which is to study ancient chronology, the timeline of history, which I'd been messing around with for about 15 or 20 years before that, all through the rock era. And I needed to have the training, university training, to be able to do that really well. And it's from there we got all the books that I've been writing about the relationship between Egypt and the Bible, which is all about chronology.
Yeah, something I've found really interesting is the fact that you have gone to university, you've done a PhD, you've done all of the academic studies. But something I've wanted to really ask you is, when did you make your mind up that the timeline that is, I guess you could say, widely accepted was wrong? Because much of your work, and something that I've really appreciated your work, is you have stood out from other scholars and other academics in your field, even if it's not popular, and said, I actually think the Egypt timeline is wrong. And yeah, I've always wanted to know, was this something that you held to throughout your university days when you were studying, or have you always kind of had a hunch or an inkling that we got it all wrong?
Well, actually, it started with a book by a very famous Egyptologist called Professor Kitchen, Kenneth Kitchen. And he wrote a little blue book. It's actually quite thick, but quite small, on a particularly obscure period in Egyptian history called the Third Intermediate Period, which comes after the New Kingdom, time of Ramesses II and Tutankhamun and all those great kings. And it fits in there after that, and it comes to an end with what we call the Late Period, or the Sayite period, the city of Sais and the Western Delta, which is basically the 26th dynasty. So it's dynasties 21 through to 25. Now, nobody taught that at university because it was so complicated, and they just jumped over it. And I was fascinated by that because I like to solve problems, puzzles. That's what interests me. And so I got this book quite early on, before I went to university. In fact, it was published, I think, in the 1970s, I think. And I got interested then by studying that book over and over again, read it several times, realized that it was so complex that there were a number of assumptions in that book which didn't add up. And yet, as the book progressed from page one through to page 400 or whatever, those assumptions became facts without any background, without any substantiation. So that's where it started, really. And having looked at it and realized that there was another way to understand that material that he'd brought together. It's the first time it had been brought together by any scholar, any Egyptologist. I mean, it was all scattered information. He brought it all together. So young bucks like me, there were several of us actually, with this volume to study, we were able to take it to pieces and reconstruct it in a different way. And that's how it all began, really. And that was the birth of something called the New Chronology, which is particularly associated with me, I suppose. And most of my books have been about how to, first of all, break down Egyptian chronology and how to then reconstruct it again. It's the thing that people never do. They're quite easy to criticize something, but they're not very good at putting it back together again afterwards. And then, to my surprise, when we did that, we found that it could be compressed, the timeline could be compressed by two or three centuries. In other words, there'd been more overlapping of dynasties than we'd previously thought. And that resulted in a comparison then with the biblical narrative, where it all seemed to fit much better together. Because the biggest problem we've had in the past is that the Bible's been treated as a myth, basically, a pious myth, because we found no relationship between Egypt and its neighbor, Israel, in the ancient archaeology, in the ancient text. And that was because they were out of sync with each other. They biblical timeline here and the Egyptian timeline were like this, and now they lock together in a much better way. And that was very satisfying. But of course, it's received a lot of criticism over the years.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've obviously read your books and your documentaries, and something that you've always sort of said is, I guess it's widely sort of acknowledged in academic sort of fields that the Bible is fiction. Like you said, it's not a historical artifact. It's not a historical document. People don't see it as history written on pages. People see it as, yeah, storytelling, basically. And a lot of the reason why is because when you read something about the walls of Jericho, for example, and you look at the timeline that historians have historically given us, you go, well, that doesn't marry up. It doesn't, there's no cohesion between the two. So it therefore it could be impossible. But obviously with your line of work, you have altered the timeline and it fits. But one thing I wanted to sort of ask you about is why you view the Bible as a historical document and not a work of fiction. Because as far as I'm aware, you're agnostic, am I right? Like you aren't a Christian. I'm a Christian, so obviously I believe the Bible to be true, but I found it incredibly fascinating that you're agnostic and yet you still see the Bible as a historical document. So I'd love for you to sort of help me and I guess the audience understand why that is so.
Okay, well, let's first of all define agnosticism, because it actually doesn't mean the same thing as being completely atheist. Okay, what it means is, it means not knowing. That's what the word means, to not have the knowledge. And that's a very honest way to look at things, because when you're confronted by the fact that the biblical narrative does not match with the archaeology and the history that we know from the other side, from the academic side, it obviously fills you with a certain amount of doubt, unless you are absolutely convinced as a Christian that every word in the Bible is true. So getting back to the question you asked, which is, why do I regard the Bible as not fiction, as something more than simple, pious fiction? The answer is that I treat the Bible exactly the same as I would any other ancient document. It's written in the ancient times. It's been amended and changed throughout history at different points. So you compare, for instance, the documents that we have from Qumran, the scrolls there, with the Masoretic text of later. There are differences. There's the differences between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint or Greek version of the Bible. So we have to consider things like that, that there may be technical errors in there, scribal errors. That's all that we need to worry about, those sorts of things. So if you look at the archaeological evidence and if you look at the biblical text, you are duty bound to try to make the two work together. Otherwise, you would have to come to the conclusion the Bible is fictitious. Now, it doesn't work with the conventional dating scheme, which is given to the rest of the ancient world by the Egyptians. The Egyptian dating is there because it's recorded on lots of documents, on stone walls, on papyri, etc. And because of the climate in Egypt, it's preserved. Whereas we have no documents in Israel of any kind. We have no inscriptions on the walls of buildings in Israel either. So we are reliant on finding Egyptian artifacts like scarabs and things like that with the names of kings in the archaeological sites in Israel to date them. Okay, so you have a mechanism to do that, but you're relying on Egyptian dating. So if the Egyptian dating is wrong, if we've made a mistake as historians in constructing the past, the BC past, the before Christ past, if we've made an error there in some way or several errors, then it's obviously going to affect the relationship with the Bible. Okay, so if the Bible is now fictitious because the Egyptian dating system says it's fictitious, then what do you do? And that's why you have academics saying that the Bible is just a myth. It's not real history. But once you realign the timeline of Egypt, it suddenly becomes genuine, real history based on archaeology.
You mentioned in one of your lectures, actually, that it was the Bible that gave the timeline for Egyptology, and then Egyptology discredited the Bible. And it was like one of those sort of weird, ironic cycles that doesn't make any sense. And I always found that fascinating. And I wanted to ask you, where did that originate from? So how was it that the Bible sort of assisted in creating the original sort of widely accepted Egypt timeline.
That's a beautiful example of circular reasoning. That's what we're going to talk about now. So let's start with the death of Solomon. Okay, now he, according to the conventional dating scheme, died in 930 BC. His reign began in 970. And that's worked out by working out all the kings' names who come in the divided monarchy period, which comes after Solomon's death, where you have the division of the country between northern Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And so you have two lines of kings. And then we have in the Bible texts which tell us when they are, when one king is on the throne in the eighth year of another king in the other line. So you can construct all this. And we have the Assyrian texts as well, which mention certain kings of Israel. So we can help to reconstruct the entire chronology going back from the sack of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, working all the way back to King Solomon's reign. And so scholars tend to say around 930 BC for the death of Solomon. Now, in the southern kingdom of Judah, he was succeeded by a king called Rehoboam, who was his son. And we have a text in both Kings and Chronicles mentioning the fact that in the fifth year of Rehoboam, this pharaoh from Egypt, the first one to actually be named in the Bible, is called Shishak. That's the first time. Everything before that is just simply pharaoh. At this point now, we have a name of a pharaoh. He's called Shishak. Marched up with an army, a huge army, and he arrived in Jerusalem having defeated all the cities of Judah, the fortified strongholds of Judah. He arrives in Jerusalem. He plunders the Temple of Solomon of all its treasure and the treasure from the palace of King David and Solomon. He takes it all back to Egypt with him. Now, okay, so there's a synchronism. We have an Egyptian pharaoh, and we have a biblical event in year 5 of Rehoboam, which is 925 BC. Based on the death of Solomon 5 years later, 925 BC. So what the Egyptologists did was they went to Egypt looking for evidence of the biblical story. And Champollion, the famous decipherer of Egyptian hieroglyphics, went to a particular scene in Karnak, which was a campaign relief of a pharaoh called Shoshenq. Shoshenq the First, who was the founder of the 22nd dynasty. In this period we talked about before, the third intermediate period, this confusing era, where there may be problems. And so they said, okay, well, he campaigned in Canaan, so he must be Shishak. The name is vaguely similar, Shishak, Shoshenq. Well, I would disagree with that. I don't think they're very similar at all. And so they said, okay, well, this campaign took place in his 20th year. That must be 925 BC, the date of year 5 of Rehoboam in Israel, in Judah. So they then back calculated the beginning of his reign to 945 BC, which is the foundation of the 22nd dynasty. You then work backwards from there through the 21st dynasty to 1069 BC, when that dynasty was begun, using all the data we have. And then we add in the 20th dynasty, going backwards again in time, until we eventually arrive in the 19th dynasty and the time of Ramesses II. So we get a date of 1279 BC, that's the regular one that everybody uses these days, for the first year of Ramesses II. So here we've used a biblical event, 925 BC, the sacking of the temple in year 5 of Rehoboam, to calculate the beginning of the reign of Ramesses II in 1279 BC. Now when you look at the reign of Ramesses, remembering that in the first chapter of the book of Exodus, it talks about the Israelite slaves building the city of Ramses and Pithom. They say, oh, well, this must be Ramesses II. So the slaves, the Israelite slaves, must have been there in the time of Ramesses II. But we have zero evidence of a large population of Semites, speaking the Semitic language, in the time of Ramesses II in the eastern delta of the land of Goshen. We have no evidence of that at all. Not only that, but we have no evidence of an exodus either. Ramesses II was one of the greatest pharaohs in Egypt's history. There's no sign in that period of any problem for Egypt, no plagues, no exodus of slaves out of Egypt. And then when we look 40 years later into the Promised Land, there's no Jericho. Jericho didn't exist at that time. Jericho had been an abandoned ruin for hundreds of years. So what happens then is the scholars say, well, if there was no Jericho at that time, there couldn't have been a Joshua, there couldn't have been a conquest, and therefore there couldn't have been an exodus out of Egypt from the time of Ramesses II. Therefore, the Bible is a pious myth. It's not real history. So you have the Egyptologists using a biblical text, the talk about Rehoboam's year five, to construct Egyptian history. And then they're using the time of Ramesses II to dismiss the Bible as a work of fiction. Now, that is really circular reasoning. It's a really wonderful example of circular reasoning. And it, as you said, it's very ironic.
I can't think of a better example than that in anything else. But for people in my audience who might not really understand what the, I guess, widely accepted timeline is and what you're suggesting the timeline should be, are you able to sort of, I know it's a very complex subject, I know, and I've read your books and gone through everything, so I appreciate that it's really hard to sort of make it concise and I guess edible for beginners, but if you could try as best you can to sort of explain what it is that your work sort of shows and maybe a few examples of that, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay, we'll try and keep it as simple as we can. Obviously, the process of reconstructing the timeline of Egypt is very complex, especially in the third intermediate period. That's where a lot of the work goes on. We don't need to worry too much about that. What we're basically looking for, and I start with, is one, when was there a city of Jericho and when was it destroyed? Because afterwards, in the archaeology, it's not occupied for 600 years. Okay, when we look at Tell es-Sultan, which is the site of Jericho in the Jordan Valley, there's a 600-year period when there is no city there at all. Okay, it comes back into life again in one of the later Iron Age periods. And that reflects, again, what the story is in the Bible, because we talk about in the time of Ahab, a guy comes along and rebuilds Jericho, okay, over the buries his own children as sacrifices under the gates and the walls, etc. So we can pin that one down there quite nicely. So let's look back those 600 years to when there was a Jericho, and that Jericho was a large city. It had 2,000 people living in it, and it had great fortified walls, a very strong city, and it was destroyed. The walls collapsed. And it was severely burnt and abandoned for 600 years. Now, that is the story of Joshua and Jericho. Okay, so when was it? It was at the end of the Middle Bronze Age, or towards the end of the Middle Bronze Age, whereas most scholars would put the Jericho story and the Exodus in the time of Ramesses II, which is much, much later in the Late Bronze Age. So we've obviously got something wrong somewhere. But when we look at Jericho, that was destroyed in the Middle Bronze Age, and we look back to Egypt then, we find a huge population of Semitic peoples living in the land of Goshen, the eastern delta of Egypt. It starts with a small village of about 70 or 80 people, maybe 15 or 16 houses, and it builds into this huge city, bigger and bigger population. At the beginning, it's very successful. The people are doing very well for themselves. They're shepherds. We know that from the burials that were found, the sacrificial sheep that go with the burials there. And eventually, their situation changes. The Egyptian pharaohs suddenly take over again and become more dominant. They enslave the population in Egypt at this time. We have documents that shows that. And then suddenly, these people living in the eastern delta of Egypt and land of Goshen, in a place called Avaris, which is the name of the city at that time, they suddenly up sticks and disappear. And then a new group come in. We call them the Hyksos. They arrive from the north and they occupy a city that's been abandoned and rebuild it. And they then punish the Egyptians for the next, well over a century. They become the dominant force in Egypt. So This goes to fit exactly with the biblical story. So from the beginnings in the end of the 12th dynasty, all the way through to the Exodus, to the conquest and the destruction of Jericho, all fits in that time period, and it doesn't fit in the later period. So the simplicity is we have to change the Egyptian timeline, shorten it, in order for it all to fit together. But it's the reasons for doing that are not to prove the Bible. The reasons for doing it is because the Egyptian chronology is wrong and it has to be corrected. The result of that is the biblical story comes to life.
And it's widely, there are movies all about Egypt and Moses and the Exodus. It's quite a popular story. And it's fascinating that in The Prince of Egypt, which is a very popular cartoon, and some of the other sort of biblical movies out there, that Ramesses is always portrayed as the Pharaoh of Moses. But in what you suggest is that's actually not the case. And you also used in one of your lectures, I saw you put up a couple of pictures of some sculptures of some pharaohs at the time. I think there were two of them. And you said they're different to every other pharaoh or sculpture that you've seen in that their facial expressions are different. And do you think that kind of can assist in showing possibly those plagues and all the hardships and all of those hard times prior to, I guess, you know, them leaving and moving on from Egypt with that exodus? And yeah, I want to sort of, if you don't mind, pick your brain a little bit about how you sort of came to the conclusion, or, you know, what you believe and who you believe to be the actual Pharaoh of the exodus and with Moses.
Okay, well, there are two. We have to bookbind this. At the front end of the book, we have the time of Joseph. When he arrives as a slave in Egypt, he's sold into slavery by his brothers. And he gets on very well with the Pharaoh at the time because he predicts Pharaoh's dreams. He explains Pharaoh's dreams. Now, I just explained to you that this village that begins with a few houses in the eastern delta land of Goshen, that is dated to the time of a Pharaoh called Amenemhat III. And he's one of the last kings of the 12th dynasty in Egypt, what we call the Middle Kingdom. He's a really powerful Pharaoh, fantastic Pharaoh. But in his time, and because he had a co-regency with his father for 20 years, both he and his father are shown with these worry lines, the downturned mouth, the sadness in their faces, the outturned ears to listen to the worries of the people. You never see that in Egyptian art in any other period. And so what scholars have interpreted this as it was a period not just of strength by these powerful pharaohs, but also a time of desperate famine as well, hardship. And that is the story of Joseph, the 7 years of prosperity, of plenty, and the 7 years of famine, interpreting Pharaoh's dreams. And so that's the time when Joseph would have arrived in Egypt towards the end of the 12th dynasty, during this co-regency between Sennuzrit III and Amenemhat III. But Amenemhat III is Joseph's pharaoh. He's the one that had the relationship with Joseph. And then we have a period we call the 13th dynasty, which lasts quite a long time, which is the time when the Israelites were in Egypt, first of all, prospering, because Joseph was a very powerful man. He continued to live beyond the time of Amenemhat III into the 13th dynasty. So he was basically in charge of the land, and it meant that the Israelites were prospering in Avaris, this city that was beginning to expand rapidly as the population increased. But then sometime towards the middle or late part of the 13th dynasty, we get a new line of kings coming from Thebes in the south who are dominant, and they enslave the population. And suddenly we find documents of lists of slaves with Semitic names given their Egyptian names, just like in America, African slaves are brought there and given English names. The same thing happened in Egypt. We have, you know, we have the Semitic name, and then we have he who is called, and then his Egyptian name. And we have lists of these people, these slaves, these domestic slaves. And then sometime later after this, the 13th dynasty collapses in the time of a king called Dudimose. Nobody's ever heard of him. He's a complete non-entity. He's not a great Ramesses II. And in his time, according to Manetho, who's the great historian of ancient Egypt, who wrote the history of ancient Egypt in the time of the Greek pharaohs, the Ptolemies, he says in his history that it's this time that God smote the Egyptians. Who God is? It's in the singular, by the way. You wouldn't expect that from an Egyptian writer to be writing about a single god. You would say the gods, yeah? But this is one god who smote the Egyptians. And then, this is as a subsequent event following the smiting, whatever the smiting is, we have this invasion of the Hyksos coming in across Sinai and taking over the land without any resistance from the Egyptian army. They just come in and they take over the land. Where's the Egyptian army? Well, it's all been drowned in the Yam Suf, the Sea of Reeds. And prior to that event, when we look at the archaeology of Avaris, at the end of this stratum of the 13th dynasty, it's called Stratum G, we find pits all over the site with bodies that have been tossed into them. Now, there's no grave goods with them. They've been thrown in on top of each other, and they're all over the place. And my view is that this may be the final plague of the 10 that we read about in the Bible, the 10 Exodus plagues, the plague where the people, the firstborn, are killed of the Egyptians. They die. They're buried in these mass graves. The archaeologists call it a plague. They don't know what kind of plague, but it was very sudden. And it's immediately after this that we then find the site is abandoned. We don't know for how long. And then these Hyksos foreigners come in and take over the country. That, to me, sounds like the Exodus. So, to answer your question, Amenemhat III is the pharaoh of Joseph's time at the end of the 12th dynasty. And Dudimos is the pharaoh of the Exodus, the king who was on the throne at the time when the Exodus took place.
And I could be getting my wires crossed here, but did you also mention something about bodies that were found in the area, and there was an increase in infants or children? I think back then there was obviously a lot more child-related deaths than there is today because of modern medicine, et cetera, et cetera. But even still, there was, I think you said it went from something to 50% more, or again, I could be butchering the statistics here. And then you also mentioned that there was a disproportionate sort of between genders in deaths. There were more or less females and males, and you sort of alluded to the fact that this could be when the firstborn, when the pharaoh was commanded people to kill the firstborn son, well, all sons actually, for the Hebrews who were living in Egypt at the time. So if you don't mind, can you kind of explain how that works, what was actually found for people who might want a couple more things of evidence related?
Well, you did that very well, I thought. You could explain it very well. Okay, so this is archaeological interpretation. So there are no texts for this. We don't read anything about it. But what we find in the ground is that typically, and you don't need to have modern statistics for this, typically when you look at ancient cemetery sites in Egypt and other parts of the world, typically infant burials represent 25% of the burial, total burials at the sites. So, and that's pretty even all the way through the ancient history, really. So 25% infants, the rest adults, the people who survive into adulthood. So in this place of Aris, at some point in time, we can't pin it down exactly, suddenly it jumps to 50% of infants' burials. Okay, so there's a doubling of the number of infants. Now, that is surprising, and it surprised the archaeologists when they found this. So then we take a second step now, and we look at the remaining adult burials, the ones who do not die in infancy, who are found in the same cemeteries. Okay, now that's the other 50% of the population, effectively. And when they've analyzed the skeletal remains of those adults, they find there are 5 females to every 3 males. Okay, which means there's a skew in the population, more females than males. So the question is, can we relate that to the increase of the infant burials? Does that mean that we've got some sort of vague evidence of the culling of the male infant Hebrews and Israelites by Pharaoh for fear of the male population becoming more dominant? They're much safer having female slaves than they are having male slaves, because the male slaves can revolt, the female slaves won't revolt. Okay, so this is the policy of the Egyptian pharaohs to make slaves out of the Israelites who had prospered in the land. So you can look at that and say, well, that's just an interpretation of the archaeology. Correct. But we have no text to prove it, but it does fit with the story of the culling of the male infants at the time of the slavery period and the time of Moses, in fact. And this probably happened around that time. We can't be sure exactly when.
It's all very fascinating. You mentioned before Joseph, and obviously that's where a lot of all of this began. You've also done quite a lot of extensive work on him, his story and timeline, and various other sort of evidences along the way. But before I get into that, because I do want to ask you a few questions about him, I wanted to sort of ask your opinion on why your timeline is still not widely accepted. Like, why would people or other academics or scholars not want to at least, I guess, investigate, or why isn't it accepted? And how has it come a long way since you've started this work in trying to sort of expose the timeline? Are people becoming more, I guess, accepting of the possibility that you could be right over the original Egypt timeline?
Yeah, well, it's been a surprise to me, to be honest. I mean, maybe I'm a bit naive, but when I thought I came up with this rather convincing argument, the academia piled in and said, oh, no, you can't do things like that. Far too radical. We can give you a couple of years here and a couple of years there. Israel Finkelstein, the great doyen of Israeli archaeology, said, I don't mind if you shift it 10 years here or 10 years there, but centuries, no chance. Okay, so it is a radical idea. There's no doubt about that. But it's a standard practice really within academia to be resistant to something radical, something new. It took more than a generation for continental drift theory to be accepted by academia. And there's probably many other examples of it. I think it was Max Planck who said that sometimes you have to wait for one generation to die out of academics before an idea can be accepted by a new generation more familiar with the ideas. So one of the issues, of course, is that most of the academic fraternity haven't read my work. They're taking the word of one or two experts like Kenneth Kitchen, who is very resistant to the ideas, and then they don't bother to read it, or they read it in a very shallow fashion. They look at the headlines and they don't look at the detail. And then there's others that say, well, in fact, Kenneth Kitchen, I had a great debate with him in a university in Britain, where at the end of the debate, he conceded that my new chronology date for Exodus was actually as strong as his own 19th dynasty Ramesses II Exodus date, although he won't release himself from the chains of that have kept him in that particular position. But he does see the possibility of it being earlier. But of course, the damage had been done by then. And so now the people say, okay, well, maybe it's quite convincing, this Joseph and Exodus thing going on in the Middle Bronze Age. But what do you do about King Solomon? What did you do about King David? Where's all the evidence there? You can't possibly do it all, which is why my most recent books are all about that period, taking it on from the Exodus now and moving into the time of the United Monarchy period, because I have to now, you know, to have all that information there. But to be honest with you, the academics won't read it anyway. So, you know, it's either going to be the fact that it'll be accepted at some time in the future when something turns up out of the ground, which is absolutely irrefutable.
Yeah.
You know, some specific piece of evidence, or it has to wait for the new generation after I'm buried in the ground and they come along in 40, 50 years' time, maybe they'll think more kindly towards it. But to me, the evidence is strong enough, and I think it's very convincing, and so I'm going to stick with it. I've not found anything really at this point in time which undermines it to such a degree that it means that it's not viable. And that, after all, is how a theory develops. A theory has to be tested and proven to be right or wrong. That is the whole point in science. That's how you work. And so it should be the same in history, but unfortunately it's not. There's an old adage that my professor used to tell me at University College London, and that is, when you walk into his office at the university and you look around the room, on the left-hand side, you have these volumes of archaeological data, the archaeological dig volumes, the reports, and on the right-hand side, you have all the histories. Okay, but the histories get binned every so often, every two or three generations. They put new books in there and they say, oh, these old ones were wrong. But the archaeology remains the same because it's the evidence. So you work with the evidence and you interpret it as history. And remember that history is not the past. History is our best guess
Now, something you've also mentioned before is that, if the Egypt timeline, the one that's accepted, is wrong, then all of what we understand in history is wrong, because much of what we understand about what's happened in the past and in history is based on that. Because, as you mentioned also before, the Egyptians had meticulous record keeping as opposed to many other groups of people around the world. So a lot of history is hinging on this one Egypt timeline. And I thought maybe that's a reason why it's not as accepted, because if you have to undo that, then history as we know it could start changing around us. And sometimes people would rather stay willfully blind because it's easier, I guess, than having to sort of confront and admit maybe that things were wrong to begin with. But I do like that you sort of have started going into like King David and Solomon and things like that. I watched a lecture that you gave a little while ago about the psalm that people say David stole from, I think it was the first monotheist Egyptian sort of pharaoh. And you sort of go into, I found it incredibly fascinating, made a lot of sense. And for people who are listening, I highly recommend that you jump onto YouTube and watch that documentary. But before I sort of start going off shooting into David and Solomon, I did want to sort of touch a bit on Joseph. And you have spent quite a number of years going through that, and I've always found it fascinating. You talk about how intelligent Joseph would have been, which is, I guess, why in the Bible it's always recorded that he was in the king's favor. You'd think a foreigner being one position under the king, like he has to be a pretty important, pretty special person to be given that. And you mentioned how there used to be periodically a lot of flooding and things like that from the Nile, and there was a massive body of water. And you believe that Joseph was actually the one that sort of engineered a way for the Nile to sort of go through there, so much so that the pharaoh of the time built a house, I think you mentioned, or a palace or something, right on that particular point. And you also then, I guess, go into how you believe Joseph was or is the reason we have our alphabet today. So I'd love for you to sort of like talk to us a little bit about your understanding of Joseph and why you think he was such a significant man in history and for our history.
So the key to this whole story really is this brilliant young man who was brought into Egypt as a slave. There is obviously this interpretation of Pharaoh's dreams. We have the worry lines on the faces of the pharaohs at this time on their statuary. And one has to wonder what type of famine it was. Obviously, there's the 7 years of plenty are all about growing mu as much wheat as possible, as grain as possible, storing it in Joseph's granaries and putting them into storage to protect Egypt from the famine years, the 7 years of famine. Well, how can that be? Well, one of the dreams that Pharaoh actually has is all about fat cows coming out of the Nile and then being devoured by lean cows. And that is the interpretation of the fat years, the plenty years, and the 7 years of the famine. Why do they come out of the Nile? Why do cows come out of the Nile? That's something the Bible does not explain. But the answer is, of course, that the Nile was the cause of the famine. Because what happened was down in Ethiopia, where the rains are in spring, there was a tropical climate, a more equatorial climate at this period of time. There was a shift in the climate zones, a little bit similar to what we have at the moment. As a result of which, the rains are much heavier in this period. Now, in the first 7 years of that period, and we can tell this from Nile level text that we have measuring the heights of the Nile, it rose several cubits, several meters above the normal flood level, the inundation level, which happens every year with the Nile. And it brings silt, fresh silt with it, etc. So in this period was a period of plenty because they had more water, they had more silt, they could expand their agricultural area to grow more grain. But then suddenly, 7 years later, according to these texts, these level texts, it shot up to about 21 meters above the normal level of the Nile. And that would have caused disaster. That would have washed away the villages, the Mudrik villages on their mounds. It would have drowned the animals in the fields. And of course, it meant that the flood waters did not dissipate for months. beyond their normal time to go away. So they couldn't plant because the fields were flooded. Okay, and it actually says that in the Bible. It says the fact that we could not plow the fields, not just that we couldn't plant, but we could not plow. Now, you can plow dry land. You can't plow flooded land. So it seems to be that the flood was the cause, this excessive water, of both the plenty and the famine, the fat cows and the lean cows. And then you have to ask yourself, well, hang on a minute, what about Jacob and his lot up in the north? Because they're up there and they have to come into Egypt because they're desperate as well because of the famine. Well, that's because the climate zones have shifted. The tropical zone has pushed into Ethiopia in that period, and the Sahara and Arabian desert zone has moved into Israel. The result of which is they've got the opposite of too much water. They've not got any rain at all, and they've got massive heat. So there's two sorts of famine going on. There's the dry famine in the north, and there's the wet famine in the south. And that fits beautifully with what we see with the Egyptian evidence at this time. So Joseph, he is the key to all this. He then organizes, he becomes the second person, most powerful person in the land. He organizes the granaries. They're actually called the granaries of Joseph. I'll tell you what his name is in Egyptian in a minute. And they fill these, and the Pharaoh takes over the land. He gets all the land from all the nomarchs and all the rich people in Egypt, and they have to give it over to the Pharaoh. So he stores it in national granaries. And then, of course, we have the hardship period, which comes afterwards. So Joseph, to avoid the hardship period, he diverts part of the floodwaters of the Nile into what we call the Fayum Basin, which is a massive lake at this time, huge lake. Diverting 50% of the water into that means that further north, the water's now receded back down to a controllable level again. And that's how he manages to save Egypt from the most severe part of the famine. Mm-hmm. So that's why when Jacob comes down to Egypt, they're asking for wheat or grain from Egypt, because Egypt is now able to grow grain again in the delta, mm-hmm. which is protected from this reduction of the flood water. So it's all down to this brilliant young mind and the engineering skills of this person. And he does become the most powerful man in Egypt. And after Amenemhat III dies, his pharaoh, and we get to the 13th dynasty, the kings are much, much weaker. And it's fact the viziers, and he is a vizier of this time. He's called, he's called chancellor or something in the Bible. But it's the term vizier we have from the Middle East. He is the most powerful person in the land now, much more powerful than the kings. Mm-hmm. Until, of course, when he dies, and after he dies, the pharaohs who did not know Joseph now take over the land again, and they enslave the population. Mm-hmm. So that's the storyline behind the Joseph thing. Now, you did mention this business of the script, the alphabet. So do you want to ask me about that? Because I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I would love to, because a lot of people think that it would probably be Moses, because, you know, you've got it. There's such different dialect, and it's like, how can one go from one to another? It has to be somebody who had a knowledge of both to be able to do it. So yeah, it's obviously, there's could only be, in my mind, two people, and that's Joseph and that's Moses. And you believe that it was Joseph. And I actually, after watching some of your lectures and things, I think I lean towards that most certainly now as likely.
That's the evidence. The evidence is that the beginnings of this, we'll call it an alphabet for the moment, this script, and I'll explain what it is in a second. That starts, the very first time we see that script in Egypt is in the reign of Amenemhat III, Joseph's pharaoh. So it can't be Moses that invented it, because it's already there before Moses is born. Yeah. So it has to be somebody in a powerful position who has learnt Egyptian hieroglyphs and how to read them, because I'll explain in a second, this new script is based on the original hieroglyphs of Egypt. And why not Joseph? He's the man in charge of the land. He's dealing with Semitic peoples all the time, as well as the Egyptians. He needs to communicate with them. Let's invent a form of script that they can read in their language, which is Hebrew. Okay. So in that reign, Joseph sits down and he looks at the Egyptian hieroglyphs and he says, okay, this symbol of an Egyptian ox, the head of an ox. Okay. Now in Egypt, it's a different word. It's ka. Okay. But in Hebrew, the word is Aleph. So I'll make the Egyptian hieroglyph for a calf head or an ox head. I'll make it the first letter of the alphabet, Aleph. Let's do the snake, okay, the Egyptian serpent, all right? Well, in Hebrew, that's Nun. So we'll make that symbol the letter N. So Nun, N, okay? Tau, letter T is a cross in Egyptian, and that becomes our letter T as well with a cross. There's loads like that. Let's look at Kaf. Kaf, for instance, the Egyptian hand, okay, becomes a hieroglyphic hand, okay, and that is the word kaf, and that becomes a ch, ka, okay, and you can go through the whole alphabet like this. So he turns thousands of Egyptian hieroglyphs into a simple alphabet of about 26 letters. And so now they use the sounds of the first letter of each of the Hebrew words representing the signs, and now Moses, couple of hundred years later, can use that to start to write the book of Genesis, can start to write the record of the Exodus journey, etc. And it goes all the way through until we get into Canaan. And then the archaeologists call it Proto-Canaanite, but it's actually Proto-Hebrew. Just like the inscriptions in Egypt in the Sinai Peninsula, there's hundreds of them in the Sinai Peninsula, it's called Proto-Sinaitic, but it should be called Proto-Hebrew. Because now scholars, and I've been explaining this for the last 15 years, 20 years, scholars now have started to decipher applying the Hebrew words to the hieroglyphic letters, which mean nothing in Egyptian when you try to read them. But when you turn them into Hebrew and you start to read them, you actually get in Sinai the words of Moses, instructions about how to use manna when you're in the desert, instructions about don't worship a golden calf. Okay, these things are all there in these texts that are carved onto the rocks of Sinai. It's the work of Moses in his hand. So it's astonishing new evidence for the Exodus once you understand that this proto-Sinaitic alphabet is actually Hebrew. Then the Hebrews or the Israelites give it to the Phoenicians. Thank you, the Phoenicians say thank you very much. And the Phoenicians give it to the Greeks. And the Greeks give it to the Romans. And we end up with our modern alphabet. So, for instance, that is the hieroglyphic sign for an ox head. Okay, turn it around 180 degrees, that becomes our capital letter A. Yeah? So, and you can do that with all these signs. Resh is actually the profile of a head and shoulders. Okay? And so you can do that all the way through. That's our letter R, which is the head and shoulders of a person. You can do that all the way through these symbols. The water sign, Mem, again, and that becomes Mayim, and that is our big letter M. So all our letters from our modern alphabet come from the Proto-Sinaitic inscriptions, and before that, the inscriptions in Egypt, which were invented by Joseph, this brilliant young man.
When I watched one of your lectures, you had some slides up there and you showed like the letter A and a few other letters and also how they evolved. Like you mentioned different groups of people throughout time, and you can sort of see that from the very beginning, even from the ox head, how it looks like an upside down A when you look at the outline. And I was watching the evolution of it, and it's undeniable. You can't mistake it for all of the letters. And I found it one of those mind-blowing moments where I was like, wow, I can really see it. So for people who might be tuning in and listening and haven't seen it, I'll put all of the links to David's lectures and things so you can watch them and you can see all of the evidence like with your own eyes, because it really does help get a picture of just how undeniable all of these sort of conclusions are. Now, I wanted
I just want to point out, you say it's undeniable, but of course the academics, they don't like it.
No.
That's the weird thing about it, isn't it? It's so obvious. You know, it is so obvious, and it's probably one of the greatest discoveries of biblical anything to do with the Bible in decades, if not centuries. And the academics say, oh, no, this is not possible, because we know the Israelites didn't arrive in Egypt until much later, and they didn't leave Egypt till the late Bronze Age. So this stuff cannot be Israelites. But of course, with the new timeline, putting the Exodus and the sojourn period in the Middle Bronze Age and the conquest in the Middle Bronze Age, that is exactly when this script comes into being.
Speaking of academics not liking to accept things, I didn't actually tell you I was going to ask you this, but I just thought of it then. The stone of Joshua that academics thought wasn't real and threw into a rubbish tip, which was then later dug up and put back. That was, to me, and there's also graffiti all over the rock and things, and that almost like broke my little historian heart, because I was like, wow, such an important find was just not believed by academics, and so it was thrown off. But for people who might not understand what I'm saying, could you sort of just briefly touch on that particular thing?
Basically, when Joshua is coming towards the end of his life, he's probably got a few more years to go, but the conquest is over. He gathers together all the tribes, the victorious tribes, at a place called Shechem, the city of Shechem. And there he erects this huge white monolith stone, plain stone. And he stands there before the people and he makes them swear a covenant to the God, Yahweh. And then, having done so, they're then dispersed to their tents and their territories, their allotted territories. And that stone stood in front of the temple of Baal Berith there, which was built later on and then was destroyed later on by Abimelech, the king, who destroyed and burnt 2,000 people inside that temple. But anyway, that standing stone was there in front of the temple at the time when Joshua was making the tribes swear the covenant to their God. And it was found by archaeologists. And in fact, the guy who found it actually said, this is the stone of Joshua. And he was sacked. He was sacked by his university and said, you can't say that. And so it was then thrown into a rubbish tip, broken in half. We have only found one half of it. And he was, he was ridiculed for it, the guy who did that. And it's quite clear that it really is the stone of Joshua, the covenant stone of Joshua. But it can't be, according to the academics, because it's much too early in time. The time of Joshua, who must be in the early Iron Age, towards the end of the late Bronze Age. You cannot be in the middle Bronze Age, where I've got the conquest. And so again, it's all about chronology and the timeline. Once the chronology is incorrectly established by academia, then the Bible becomes all myth. Once you re-establish the chronology in the correct timeline, then the Bible becomes real through archaeology.
Yeah, and something else, an archaeological find, which I found fascinating, and in my mind, I'm like, it could not be anything else, was the House of Jacob, and how there were all of these burial sites sort of found, and you found a couple with some daggers and things, which were mentioned for some of Jacob's son in the Bible, and then the 12th grave burial site was a pyramid, and you sort of deduce that has to be Joseph, because all the 12 tribes of Israel are there, and why would you have a pyramid? And then in the Bible it also says how Joseph wanted to be buried with his people and things, and in the promised land. And so if you actually, I think they found in this burial site, it appears that this ceramic thing was shattered and there was nothing actually found in there other than a sculpture. Am I getting that right?
Yes, you are. Basically, yes. Let's go through that story, because it's very interesting. This little village in Avaris in the land of Goshen, which starts in the reign of Amenemhat III, as I said, a dozen houses, maybe 15 houses. At the heart of it is a Syrian-style house, what the archaeologists who are German, Austrian, called it, a Mittelsaal house, or a middle room house. And it's unique to the area of Haran and that region up in the north, which, of course, is where the patriarchs came from, that part of the world. So it's there in the middle of this village, surrounded by the other houses. Now, I think that's the House of Jacob, when he's brought into land. Because don't forget, Pharaoh says to Joseph, Jacob and his tribe can settle in the best land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen. So he's given them the right to do so. And interestingly, Manfred Bietak, who's the archaeologist, the great archaeologist of Avaris, said Pharaoh gave this land to the Semites. You know, they didn't just come here and occupy it, they were given it. Okay, so this house is there at the beginning, and then it's demolished. Okay, now that's quite normal in the ancient world. When a patriarch dies or a great man dies, you're not allowed to reoccupy his tent or his house. So you demolish it. Okay, and on top of it, the archaeologists found a very large palace. And it was an Egyptian-style palace. But the resident of that palace, we know from the graves you mentioned in the garden behind the palace, were Semites. The guy who ruled in that palace was a Semite. Okay, now it's up in the northeastern delta, so he's probably an official, probably a vizier of the Northlands, who is in charge of that region up there. Okay, and that sounds like Joseph to me. Now, Joseph was Egyptianized, so he would have had an Egyptian palace. He was mummified, we know that as well. He was embalmed, so he would have had an Egyptian too. Okay, now what's remarkable about it is there are 12 main tombs in the garden behind this palace, one of which is a pyramid tomb. Okay, now it's associated, according to the archaeologists, with the man who built the palace. Okay, and it's a pyramid tomb. Now, in this period, and in fact, for most of Egyptian history, only pharaohs and their queens had pyramid tombs. No officials would have had a pyramid tomb. But this guy is so important that he gets a pyramid like a king. Okay. And what they found was that there was a chapel in the front of this pyramid. And inside it, they found the broken remains, the shattered remains of a seated statue, which was about twice Bly's size. And this statue, that part that did survive was the head and the shoulders. The hair is bright red, flame red colored. His skin color is yellow because the paint is still there on the statue. And he's wearing a multicolored coat. Mm. Okay, so as soon as I saw that, I thought, oh, you know, this fits into the story beautifully. Okay, the great vizier of Egypt. Okay, so his original multicolored coat, his coat of many colors, was covered in blood by his brothers and handed over to Jacob to say that his son had died. But you can bet your bottom dollar that Joseph would have had a few more made afterwards when he was vizier in Egypt. And that would have been the iconic image of him in his multicolored coat. And that's what they would have done with the statue to commemorate him. Now, when they actually excavated the tomb, which was buried underneath the pyramid, in the ground, they found a vaulted chamber, mud brick chamber, and inside they found no body, they found no coffin, they found no mummy beads, no gold, no ceramics, no pots, nothing. There was a tiny few fragments of bone which came from graves that had been dug in from above later on, which had penetrated down, but no complete remains, no coffin, no accoutrements of a burial. Okay. And they found a tunnel which had been dug from behind the statue in the chapel down into the burial chamber, which was done in ancient times to remove everything from the chamber. Now, tomb robbers do not take bones away. Okay, they might take the precious metals and the jewelry, etc., but why would they take the body? Okay, the only way we know that story works is when Joseph is on his deathbed, he asks the people around him, please, when you leave Egypt, take my body with you and rebury me in the promised land. And that's what happened to Joseph, because when Moses, following the last day of the Exodus, and they were told to leave Egypt, he ordered the removal of the body of Joseph and the burial goods and took them with him on the 40-year journey to the promised land. He was reburied at Shechem, the place I mentioned earlier where Joshua erected the covenant stone. And that's why the tomb is empty. It's also why the tomb statue was smashed, because that's the revenge that the Egyptians took out on the man who had brought these cursed Hebrews into Egypt and caused the destruction of the land of Egypt and the death of all the army in the sea and the death of the firstborn. That's why they attacked the statue, because that's all they had left to attack. And the statue could not be taken away to the promised land because it was too heavy. It was twice life size. So it was left behind and the Egyptians attacked it.
Hmm. And I think you mentioned also in a lecture that the part of the statue that you can't find or you can't see, you've only got sort of the top half, but the bottom half on the robe in the middle is where you believe the name would have been written. And you said that his name would have been different. It would have been differently in, I don't know if I can attempt to try and say it, but it was a different name.
We'll have a go. It's complicated, this. Okay. It says in the Bible that Joseph was given a new name by the Pharaoh, Zaphnath-Paaneah. Okay. Now, that's because, and you'll learn understand in a minute, is Pharaoh said, well, what's unique about Joseph? It's the fact that he was believed to be dead. His father believed him to be dead for 17 odd years or whatever it was. And then when Jacob found his son was alive, the man who lives, the one who lives, is how the Egyptian word is translated. It's not Zaphnath-Paaneah, it's Zaphnath-Paaneah. Now, Aneah is how the Egyptians pronounce the word Ankh, which is the symbol of life. So Pa-an-Ankh or Pa-aneah means the one who lives. Mm. And Zaphnath means he who is called, the one who lives. So this is like the list I told you before. Semitic name, Yosef.
Hmm.
And then it's Jeduaneth or Zaphnath, he who is called the one who lives, the name given by Pharaoh to say to his father, the boy lives, the man lives. And so that is a really good explanation of why the Egyptians gave him that name. And it's typical of the period that anybody who is a Israelite or a Hebrew is given an Egyptian name. That is the tradition.
Hmm. Very fascinating. When I watched that, I it doesn't make sense to be any other answer than that. And sometimes the truth is simple. It is simple. It does smack you straight in the face. You know, the truth doesn't owe us anything. The truth is the truth. It's objective, regardless of what you want to feel about it. So, that's how I sort of see it. Like, I like that it fits what I understand in the Bible to be true, and I like that the evidence kind of points to it to be true and, you know, happy days. I'm aware of the time. I'm aware that we're a little bit over, but if you don't mind, I would, if you have another 5 minutes, I'd love to sort of touch on a documentary that you did on the Garden of Eden. Yeah. Now, for me, that was incredibly fascinating. As a Christian, I was like, I would love to know where it all started, because I think people misunderstand often the idea of Eden. People think that the whole world was Eden, but my understanding and my theological understanding is it was a garden, and it was a specific spot. It wasn't something that was the whole world, and then the whole, you know, sin came into the world and the whole world was cursed and fall under sin. My understanding was that it was controlled. It was a garden. And then from there, as the fruits of Adam and Eve multiplied, they would extend that garden into the world. But think that you found where it could have been, and you think you found it based on the four main rivers that are mentioned in Genesis. I absolutely loved watching it. I wouldn't say conspiracy theorists, because it's not really conspiracy, but the intriguing parts of my personality, which I just get fascinated with things, just absolutely loved watching it. And I actually said to myself, I want to visit there one day just so that I can say I've been to where Eden is. But yeah, if you could kind of tell us a little bit about how you and why you wanted to find where that is and what you found, that would be great.
Yeah, it all starts with chapter 2, the book of Genesis, doesn't it? Where we have this explanation of where Eden is. And it says that a river flowed through Eden. It's very factual. There are no miracles here at all. A river flowed through Eden, and it became four rivers. And the word that's used is Roshim, heads. And that means headwaters. Okay. So you have four headwaters that flow down into Mesopotamia, okay, and also sort of Caspian Sea. We know two of those names because it's already mentioned there. One is the Hiddekel, which is the Tigris today, the Greek Tigris. And the other one is the Pharat, which is the Euphrates. Okay, so those have been known for right the way back in time to the Mesopotamian period. So all we have to do is to trace those rivers back to their sources, their headwaters, to find where Eden is. Okay, now that once you do that, you can find there are two other main rivers in that region, and they flow into the Caspian Sea to the east, and they all have their headwaters in one area, which is basically Ararat, that region up there, the biblical Ararat, which is ancient Urartu and Sumerian Arata. They're all the same place. And in the east of that area, which is what gets described, is a valley, which is to the east of Eden, or in the east of Eden. And that must be the garden, the place that they call the garden in the Bible, Gan Eden. And Eden or Edina is the word for uncultivated land. So it's not in the cultivation zone. It's a natural garden. And our other word for it is Paradesa, which is a Persian word, which means paradise. We use the word paradise for the same imagery there. And that is effectively a walled garden, the Persian walled garden, which is the fourfold garden, because it has a fountain of water in the middle and four channels running off from the center, which is like the four rivers of Eden. You see it in all the architecture. You see it in, for instance, the Taj Mahal, which is also, you know, part of that whole culture. So you have this valley surrounded by mountains on three sides, so it's walled. And on the west side, there is a marshland and a salt lake, so it's not accessible from that side. And there's an eastern path leading out over the mountains into an area called Nokdi, okay, which is the land of Nod. Okay, you go north of this mountain range which separates the garden from other parts of the world, and you have the Gihon River, which is the Gihon of the Bible, one of the four rivers of Eden. So, and the other one is to the south, the Pishon, which is the Uizon, also flows to the Caspian Sea. So you have all four rivers, Euphrates, Tigris, Gihon, and Pishon, all in that area. You have the land of Cush, Cush-Adag, which is also where the Gihon flows. That area is still called Cush-Adag today, the mountain of Cush. You have the land of Nod in the east, which is where the exile goes. You know, Cain is exiled to that region. So all these things are there in that region. And there is an astonishing mountain called Mount Savalan today, which is the mountain of the chalice, which looks down on this garden. It's a snow-capped mountain. It's a volcano. And at the heart of it, there is a chalice-like volcanic crater, which is full of water. Okay, and it flows down and becomes the river that flows through the valley in the garden. Okay, that is the mountain of God that you see in Ezekiel. Okay, because it's the place where there is hot coals, that the great winged creatures, the guardians of Eden, living amongst the red hot coals. That's a volcanic structure. Okay. So this spring water that comes down there, and up in that area, there are troglodyte villages, which are carved into the lava flows. And people have lived there for thousands of years in this area. And it's a really weird, wonderful place to go and visit. But if you're going to go there, it's in Western Iran, and it's not the easiest place to get to. I've been there seven expeditions from Mesopotamia, traveling through Khuzestan to Luristan to Kurdistan and up to Azerbaijan, through the Zagros Mountains, through all this region. Not safe, not easy to travel, quite dangerous. And besides which, at the moment, I wouldn't recommend anybody go touristing in Iran just right now because of what happens to people who visit Iran at the moment. But believe it or not, the Ayatollah actually accepted this location in my book about this whole area, which he now accepts now as the location of the Garden of Eden and Eden. So although many academics, of course, will put it down in the Persian Gulf underneath the water there, doesn't make sense to me. That doesn't make any sense. That's not where the headwaters of the four rivers are.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'm not sure I'll get there into Iran anytime soon, but it would be a dream. Maybe one day, who knows? But until then, I'll live vicariously through your journeys there and enjoy watching them and learning from you and from your experiences there. I'll wrap it up now. I'm aware that we've been going for the hour. I guess that's the only disappointing part about this interview is that it has to end because there are so many things I'd love to talk to you about. Pre-Diluvian days, Genesis 6, your thoughts on that. But we'll leave that for now. But just before we go, I'd love to sort of give people an opportunity where they can follow you. So if you have any specific sites or channels that you can, I guess, direct people to, I'd really love that. And not only that, are you looking at writing any more books and what's on the agenda for the near future for you?
Okay. Well, I'm not a big internet website type person. I'm so busy. I haven't got time to maintain a website. There's one or two lurking around there. If you just type my name into Google, you'll probably find near a million different websites, to be honest. But you'll find some there. They might call it the official website of David Roll. And there's some nice articles in there that you can read that are online there. But mainly, join me on Facebook. I'm always putting stuff on Facebook. So there's that there. But I would say that the most important thing now is that there are new books that need to be read. You know, even if you've not read my early works from the 1990s, I've been still writing steadily. You know, as you mentioned, this legend, The Genesis of Civilization book, which deals with the Eden area, you can still get that book in paperback. You can probably even find a second-hand copy of the hardback. But there's a book called Exodus Myth or History, which was published in the States a few years back. Beautiful book in full color, hardback on art paper, 400 and something pages with charts and maps, plans, photos. I always believe that when you present an argument, you don't just write about it, you show the visuals so that people can see for themselves what the evidence is. Now, that book is a hardback and it's not cheap. And if you're in Oz, then it's going to cost you a fortune to get it ordered from America by post. So you can might as well get it on Kindle or one of the ebook versions there that you can get. And the great thing about these ebooks is you can highlight stuff and you can find things very easily. So it's all in color. So don't use a black and white Kindle, whatever you do, use a color version. And then there's that was published a few years back now, and that has all the stuff about the Exodus in it and the conquest and the period of time through the Sinai desert, the 40 years wanderings. But I've just completed last year a book called Legendary Kings, Volume 1, okay, because it's in two volumes.
Yeah.
And that deals with the period from the Judges period with a bit about the Exodus and stuff, all the new information that's come along recently since I last published a book. And that goes all the way through to the time of King Saul and some amazing evidence there of him and the Amarna period in Egypt and Akhenaten and monotheism and all those things. That's in volume one. And on the Kindle, if you go to Amazon, it's actually in three parts. So you can download one at a time and it's much cheaper that way. And, you know, it's not a huge thing. And volume two is on its way. So Legendary Kings volume two, which will be David and Solomon, Pharaoh's daughter, through all the way through the divided monarchy period, right the way down to the time of Nebuchadnezzar and the sack of Jerusalem. So that will be volume two. So I'm completing, as it were, the whole biblical story from my early books, from the Exodus and the time of Joseph and the sojourn, all the way through now to the fall of Jerusalem, so that people can see how the whole thing fits together so beautifully. When we get to Solomon, it's really fantastic stuff. It's really exciting. We even have letters from King Saul in the British Museum, tablets written by King Saul to Pharaoh Akhenaten, and it's all in those books, and it's very exciting stuff.
It is very exciting, and I, for one, I'm a hard back book person. I love having a physical book. So I'm going to spend the money from all the way over in Oz to make sure I get these volumes because I love putting those things in my bookshelves. But yes, the electronic ones are also great for, like you mentioned, if you really want to study it, highlight and look things up. So I encourage everybody, please do go and follow David's work. He's done some amazing things and I guarantee you will not regret picking up his books and reading them, watching his documentaries, following his lectures. But I just wanted to wrap up and say thank you again so much for coming on to this little podcast in Australia. It's been such a pleasure and I really appreciate your time today.
It's been good fun. It's lovely to meet you, and let's do it again sometime. Thank you.